Welcome to the Chicago Camps Podcast, brought to you in partnership with Simplecast. Publish your podcasts the easy way at simplecast.fm. Today, we're speaking with Boone Sheridan, a speaker camp mentor for Speaker Camp Boston on October 11th. Boone is a product designer at NASDAQ OMX and brings a wealth of public speaking experience, including a very famous on-stage photo from UX Week 2014.
Hey, Boone.
Hey, Russ. How's it going?
Good. How are you doing today?
I am on the third cup of coffee, so the world is starting to make a lot more sense right now.
That's excellent. Hey, thanks so much for being one of our mentors for Speaker Camp Boston. And what I'm hoping is that you can help all of these wonderful folks listening understand how you got your start in public speaking.
Sure. First of all, thanks for having me. I'm actually incredibly excited to meet all these folks, and doing this is going to be a highlight for my year. So this is going to be quite a bit of fun for me. As far as myself getting involved in public speaking, it's a tortuous path, like many things in life. My parents were very involved in politics, and they took me to a lot of debates, took me to a lot of events where people had to explain their positions and your planks for your campaigns. And that made it very clear to me that speaking well, speaking clearly, and getting up on stage was important. And it also seemed incredibly natural to me. I think growing up as a kid, I thought that since my mom was a member of the League of Women Voters and every weekend she was going to events where people were speaking, this was kind of something everyone did. And as I got into high school, I took some declamation courses and started to do more and more speaking, you know, on a small scale. I did a handful of terrible runs at open mic nights for comedy. I also did a handful of voice acting jobs over the years. So it put me in a place where getting up on stage was just natural. So as I went a little further in my professional career, I started doing speaking and presenting at work. For better or for worse, when it came time to do a big show and tell, when there was an executive in town, or there was something to be done for clients or prospective clients, I was often the one put in the front of the room. After that, it just seemed a natural jump to do workshops and to lead some speaking exercises and eventually do what might be considered more professional speaking at conferences and the like.
Oh, I love that. I found myself in a lot of unnatural scenarios where I think even in high school and stuff, I certainly loved being the center of attention as much as I could get it. Once I was comfortable, I'm ridiculously introverted, but I never appear that way because I get comfortable in front of people, or I'm so terrified that the only thing I can do is run toward kind of being a little goofy, I think. And I did the band thing and the acting thing, and those were lots of fun, and they felt kind of normal and natural. I think where it got interesting to me was maybe about 15 years ago, I realized that once I started learning something, I had an obligation to share it. And I think you feel this way similarly. We've had other discussions where you gain this knowledge about a topic or a subject and something has worked for you. Now it's time to share it with other people because the audience is way more important to grok onto what you've got, especially in this user experience field where we're pretty darn young, I think, to share those things out so people can take those and run with them, or you can validate their own thinking and help others. I think that for me was a big thing. Is that pretty similar for you?
Absolutely. I want to jump back to what you said a little bit earlier, and that is that the core of this, I think that people forget, is fear is an amazing motivator. Putting yourself in the position to be on stage is easy. But the second before you step up in front of a crowd, I think you'll hear this from lots of performers, the second before a curtain opens or a light comes up or someone announces your name, you know, there's a moment of primal fear and response. And fight or flight is wonderful. And, you know, the idea of, I am certain that there are events where people have fled the stage.
Wasn't that Michael Bay last year?
It's entirely possible. Although, you're right, I forgot about that. I forgot about Michael and him just wilting under those questions. But those are so rare, right? But it's that sense of, okay, everything led up to this. Let's make this happen. I've got to be at my best. I've got to make my story worth telling, and I have something to share. And I think that's exactly it. I think what's interesting is the idea of One of the benefits of speaking for me is helping push my ideas further. It's great to have a few ideas and think they're worth sharing, but it's one thing to have a conversation with people, especially over a drink or two, where suddenly after three drinks, your idea seems fantastic and you go to bed happy. But if you have an idea that you think is worth sharing and something that you want to bring to people, there is nothing as, again, primal as that feedback of someone who walks up to you after a talk and says, you know, you had me until this, and I want to talk about where you went after that, because you've done your best. You've made your case. And when I go back again to this sort of, maybe it's viewing it from the political speaking aspect where you're trying to make your case and someone says, no, I totally agree with you up to this point, and I want to talk about that. And it just takes you to so many interesting places that don't appear in normal conversations, don't appear in the normal email exchanges or blogs. Or, I mean, technically, I think you can have an idea exchange on Twitter, but holy crap, how long does it take to make it happen?
Without the benefit of animated GIFs, it takes a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. No, I wholly agree with what you're saying, and I think that's where some of the best discussions can happen. And the thing to mention there is when people have come up to me after a presentation and haven't thoroughly agreed with something or definitely disagree, it's rarely contentious. And in fact, I think the points in time where I've had anybody even overtly object to anything I'm saying in a presentation are null. I think even Jared may have had one, you know, where people actually say something counter in the audience. And I think that's a big part of public speaking that terrifies some people, is that, oh crap, somebody in the audience is going to call me on this as BS. How do I react to that? There's that fear. And I think I draw a mental line. I can see it in the ground before I walk on stage. And that is that's the terror point where it's, oh my God, I'm scared. And when I cross this, there's no turning back. What I've learned to do is draw that line as my foot is crossing it. So my terror moment is minimized.
Absolutely. And I'm all for terror minimization as a general approach in life. So that's just flat out good, period.
That felt like a nice hug. Thanks, Boone.
To that point, I wish I had embraced the idea that the audience wants you to succeed and will support you earlier in my career. Now, the benefit I had from exposure to political speech and comedy and acting might have given me, why don't we remove all the weak words here, Sheridan? It gave me a somewhat defensive approach at first, and it hindered me because I was trying to make sure I made my argument rock solid and that perhaps I boxed off a point or I blocked off a point of conversation without needing to.
Gosh, you know, I'm sorry for cutting you off, but you know, that's an amazing point in that one of my favorite things, and we put this in Speaker Camp, the book too, is it's okay to not know an answer to a question. It's okay to not cover every single base because you're up there for 20, 30, 35 minutes and you can't cover everything. You can only hope to hit a point or two in 7 to 10 minutes. It's okay not to get everything, and it's okay to tell somebody, wow, I didn't cover that. I don't know. Let me look at it and get back to you, or let's have a conversation later. That's so okay.
Absolutely. And the idea that you, even in a long workshop, a half day workshop, you can't cover everything, a full day workshop, it's impossible. And this isn't stand up where a heckler is going to savage you out loud in the moment. You know, that doesn't mean Twitter won't blow up with random comments, but
That doesn't even happen anymore.
Yeah, even that, that's just kind of weird. But it changes your approach. I think I embraced it fully a little while ago when I started to do things like tweeting directly before my talk in a conference saying, if you're not doing anything, you should come see my talk. And someone who is far more established than I am walked up to me afterwards and said, that was brilliant. I saw people standing looking at your room and the other room and trying to make up their mind, and they saw you say, hey, come see me, and they just put their phones away and went right to your room.
I'm stealing that. That's awesome.
Absolutely. And before I've gone on stage, I just had the pleasure of being at UX Week in San Francisco.
One of my favorite events, by the way. How outstanding.
Absolutely. And one of my goals has always been to get a picture with Jesse James Garrett on stage. That for me is sort of a professional bucket list. And so I tweeted to people, would you please make sure you take a picture of Jesse and myself when we're on stage doing a Q&A? It would be very cool, and it would be sort of a life goal for me.
Well, are you referring to the picture that had a very specific background in it?
Yes, I am. Yes,
I love that picture. That picture seriously made my weekend and made me insanely jealous not to be there this year.
And dozens of people took pictures. It wasn't a case of, who's this jerk? Everyone went, oh, cool. Here's something I can do for you. You're up on stage for me for 30 minutes. The least I can do is take a picture. And I got tweets and I got people sending me them an email. It just highlighted that sense of, we're all here to have a good time. We're all here to do something together. And that sense of a line between myself and the audience became obliterated, and it's led to such amazing things since.
I absolutely love that. And gosh, we've gotten so far ahead of this, but I want to ask you anyway, what was the first conference you spoke at?
I was thinking about this. I think the first conference I spoke at formally where there were badges and a program was, well, that's the key now. We've gone into this strange space where I spoke at user groups and meetings, and I taught a few classes as a guest speaker. But I think around 2010 or 2011 was that first time someone handed me a badge and said, hey, you're in the program. And I think it was either EuroIA or the MIMA Summit in Minneapolis.
Nice. And how'd that go?
They were both fantastic. It was, EuroIA was an interesting challenge for me because it was a topic I believed in, but it was a very fractured talk. And it led to something that I have used going forward for a long time. And that is, my own stress as a speaker is that I'm not solid that at any point in time, I'm going to be the smartest person in the room. There's always more to learn. There's always something more to know. And you can't, as we just spoke about, you can't know everything. I can try to be, and hopefully am when I'm on stage, the person who brings it together the best in the moment, makes people laugh, and I give people a good experience, and they walk away going, I'm glad I was there. It wasn't a waste of my time. That is my darkest fear.
I'm glad we've talked about that, because my next question to you is, what was your worst or least significant, you know, least significantly good in some way, like your conference presentation or conference that you were at?
I think it was your OIA because the story wasn't perfect. And that's actually a terrible way to say it, because no story is ever perfect. I had the story. I had the thread of what I wanted it to be. I think, bluntly, there were too many words on my slides. I was asking people to read, and I was confusing the issue. And so the fun part of it is I had sat down with my wife and said, I'm not going to be the smartest person. There are going to be a ton of smart people there. I've got to focus on telling my story. If I can give people a great experience, make them laugh, and teach them something, then I will be happy. And the best part of the story is I'm in Prague doing my talk. On the other side of the world, my wife is watching Twitter, and someone who I respect a great deal, as a matter of fact, is Mike Atherton, tweets during my talk something along the lines of, I'm not sure what this gentleman is saying, but he is very funny and his slides are very pretty. And she said, I know he's doing all right. She could close Twitter and go to bed.
That's awesome. And you know, gosh, we all have dogs. There's no doubt about that. The trick, of course, is to never quit, and don't let your dog presentation, and I've got a more than my share. In fact, I am pretty sure if I was lucky, I did a C- and a half day workshop at UX London. And every now and then I secretly hope Andy Budd will hear me admit that, so they'll give me another chance. That said, how did you recover from that particular thing?
I sat down and looked at what I was presenting and realized that I had just too much information I was trying to get onto a slide, onto a screen, and that forced me to change my story as I was going on. No matter how complex the story, the job of a speaker, if you have any job when you're on stage, it's to transmit information simply and efficiently. And that sounds somewhat robotic, but the sense is, if you go up on stage and you make people read a lot of slides and you make people follow you through this mousetrap-like contraption or a Rube Goldberg type of thinking, unless that payoff is huge, people aren't going to want to do it, and they're not going to necessarily get there with you. So you're going to wind up somewhere where you're not happy and they're not happy.
I love to watch presidents. Gosh, I love to watch presidents, even if they're not, you know, who I would politically affiliate with, how they hammer points home. Those professional speechwriters, you know, when you hear them repeating a phrase every 2 minutes, and it's brilliant when you see that happen and how they get the whole message in there.
I think there's something important there you said as well, and that is a callback. And I think that is the way I have tried to fix or get better at this particular issue. And it's something that I had learned years ago from doing comedy. And that is the callback, the making sure you go back to a point, you illuminate that point, you add to it, you build it, you bring people into the talk, you bring people in. As you mentioned, great political orators let you know what they're going to say. They take you along as they're saying it. They bring it back time and again. There is a very cynical person I met years ago who was a speechwriter and said repeatedly over multiple drinks that he essentially writes 5-minute speeches and then has to say the same thing in 5-minute chunks to build up to 30 or 60 minutes because it's message management. This is the thing I'm going to say, and I'm going to say it in my voice, and I'm going to say it how it affects you, and then I'm going to say it how the world sees it. And that sense of that narrative in a political sense can get really grindy, but a callback and a narrative and a touchstone and a talk, when it works, it's just a thing of beauty, and people walk out going, oh, no, I totally get it.
I could not agree more, and I don't know why. Well, I do know why, but I keep thinking about one of the Jared School talks where he mentions chicken sexing. Not sexting, but you know how baby chicks are, how they can tell the sex of them. Have you heard this talk of his?
Yes.
And it took me forever to understand that message because I was so wrapped up in giggling like a 12-year-old child that it took me a while to realize that some things you just have to do repeatedly until you understand how they work. Duh, the very simple message of duh, oh snap, I just got it type of thing. But that, again, that's that touchstone of as you see this stuff and go back to it, that he's got this magical piece in there, that little story that makes you realize you have to go through, take some knocks, go through, take some knocks, and then wow, I'm the best wireframer. Now I can go on to the next thing. It's sheer brilliance when you watch these guys. And we're absolutely lucky to have Jared with us too. I'm gonna keep going because this is probably the longest podcast that we've recorded, and don't get me wrong, I love it. This is fantastic. What do you think is the one thing that you wish you knew about public speaking in this sort of conference way before you got started or when you started doing more of it?
More than anything, I wish I'd had more insights into reading an audience. And by that, I mean my experience in speaking was, again, I touched on politics and stand-up comedy and the like, and it led me to read an audience a certain way. So I did a workshop at the MEMA Summit, and there were times when I thought I was bombing, dying. I had to move around because I was afraid there might be a pool of flop sweat on the carpet at the hotel. There were dark moments of the soul because the looks on people's faces were dour. They were shaking their heads the wrong way. They had that tilted look, and they looked like they were unhappy or that they were just so frustrated with me.
There's always that one person in the audience, for me, that I look at and I can't help it, and I am terrified of what that person thinks. Don't know them, doesn't matter. There's a look about them and the way I look at them that makes me go, that person's going to be the person. That will be that, oh my God, that's going to be the person who stands up and says, everything you said, Russ Unger, is BS, and I'm going to fall over dead.
And absolutely. It's an emotional fight or flight response where someone is giving you all of the signals. You know, if we were animals in the wild, someone would be clearly flaring their eye spots or they'd be showing plumage to say, I am, and now we must fight.
It's like that thing on the Today Show, that resting
Resting bitch face.
Yes, it's like that. However, it's implied by you, me, mm-hmm. onto the person, because we don't know them. We don't know if that's their resting bitch face or not. We've just decided that it is. In fact, the great quote I just saw yesterday is, fear makes the wolf bigger than he is.
Mm-hmm. And absolutely. And here's the key to this story. When I was done, multiple people who had had those looks came up to me and said amazing things. And the common theme to the three or four people who I had been freaking out over was, that was amazing. I was really grinding to think about the things you were telling me. And I was really thinking hard about what you said. And I got to admit, it worked. It's amazing. So there's a difference between that I don't believe you face, and there's a difference between the, you are blowing my mind and I need to think about this, and I'm taking in every word and processing it. And unless you know the person intimately, you don't know that face.
Yeah, it's the ponder face. You know, or the looking down and you think they're ignoring you, but maybe they're taking notes, maybe they're doodling. Hell, maybe it's another presenter and they're just focused on their talk because it's next and they're nervous as you were an hour ago. It's all of that stuff at once. And I'll tell you, this is one of the things that's led me to have my number one speaker note is slow down in the largest font I can fit it in the space, because I remember that I've just given some dense information.
Absolutely. It all ties together, that sense of give the information at a cadence and a pace that people can absorb it. Don't worry if people are going to go at a different speed. I think this all wraps up in this point of, you can't predict how people are going to respond and absorb the information you're sharing with them. And it's incredibly common. My wife, Caro, just did a workshop at a quilt guild. She talked about photography and quilting, and she finished it and she came back and said, I had a great time, but you know what? There was someone in the front row who just had that scrunchy face and they were freaking me out, but I remembered what you told me. And she kept her cool. She did her talk. And that person was one of the first people to walk up to her after and say, that was amazing. I've never thought about it like that. So if I don't know that I have a lot of honest to goodness tips or advice to give, but that is about the only one I'm convinced is the most valuable of anything I can offer. The feedback you get from an audience is incredibly hard to decipher, and you can choose to act on it with fear. You can choose to act on it as an energy boost. You can say, I'm losing the room, I'm going to bring them back, or you can come up with another response, but it's something that you can't always prepare for it, and it will hit you the first time.
I've said it more than once, and I know I said it with Jen Downs, but, and in fact, I think I've got it in one of my presentations, where to me, being a public speaker, a presenter at a conference, is a lot like being a drummer, in that you've got all four limbs going. You've got this amazing content you pulled together, and you spend a week or two worth of your life, you know, probably in your own time, pulling together, designing slides, doing research, and you have to remember all of your marks and all of these things, and you've been so focused on that, and then you realize you're also the lead singer of the band, so you've got to know what to do on stage, how to move it, what your presence is like, how to make the laptop present the right way, make sure you're mic'd correctly, and understand that if you're wearing a lavalier, you move with your shoulders, not with your head, and then you have to try to read this audience who have all these different faces that it's like a baby. You can't tell if they're happy or if they've got gas. And you've got to try to manage that all at once. So you're like Dave Grohl, where you're the drummer who is also the lead singer. And it's an amazingly not easy task. And where I'm going with this, believe it or not, is that you just said you didn't think you have all of these great things to tips and advice to people. This has been, you know, half an hour of incredible advice. And I think where your value is that you've seen these things and you've stepped in it, which is, I think, what we've all done. We've stepped in it, and we can share that with people and try to help them avoid the piles of things that we've stepped in. And that's invaluable, because I don't believe that as a community, and no disrespect to our community when I say this, we aren't the best at saying, here's how you do this. Here's how you share and disseminate information to others to help them learn and follow your path and not make the same mistakes and to be more successful. So I think that's huge, Boone.
Thank you. And what I love about what you just said is that the change, the pick whatever image you want, the tectonic plates, the quantum shift, I feel like in the late 90s and the early part of the 2000s, speaking was a bar that was raised very high. And it's odd because in business, when I worked at IBM in Austin, they took the time to coach me. They sent me to Toastmasters. IBM told people, you need to become a good speaker. It will benefit us as a company. It will benefit you as an individual. And it is something that there is almost no downside.
Couldn't agree more.
One of my challenges with the way the economy shifted and living in Austin, where it became a monumental startup boom and bust cycle, that went away. And it was the criticisms of IBM were of an old culture that didn't respond quickly. But by the same token, they cared. This is going to sound really hokey, but I loved working for IBM because they cared as much for the person and their skills because they knew that they got a benefit from it at work. And the startup boom that I was involved in Austin was basically just, hey, will you sleep under your desk? Okay, cool. Thanks. Here's some, here's a keychain. Here's a hoodie. And, there's snacks in the break room. Okay, cool.
So why are you still doing public speaking today?
Selfishly, it is the best way I know to meet a ton of smart people wicked fast. When I go to a conference, you get to meet so many people and you have a conversation starter. As a speaker, if people want to start a conversation, they know who you are and what you're speaking about. So suddenly you've jump-started a conversation and you don't necessarily get caught in a room full of people going, so do you,
what's your major?
Like, do you like stuff? and that's a benefit that sometimes I don't think is spoken about enough. You're put in a situation where people want to talk about things. They're interested in an idea. It was an amazing opportunity for me to reach out to people as a speaker at one event to go up to another speaker who I'd been a drooling fanboy of for years and say, hi, I couldn't get a sentence out from 30 seconds. It was, and this person just patted me on the shoulder and said, it's awesome to meet you. I love what you do. And I had this moment of,
I still feel that way around Jesse James Garrett. And I love Jesse, and we've had drinks and conversations, but I still feel that way around Jesse.
And that's awesome because it gives you that sense of people talking about stuff. You can share stories. And again, it's a very personal benefit that I think sometimes people don't recognize. But professionally, the reason I still do a lot of public speaking is that it helps push me and my ideas. We touched on this earlier, and that sense of, I think I've got a good idea. I think I've thought of some things, but to really put it in a crucible and really burn away the dross and see what's left is to get up on stage and present these ideas as worthy of a stranger's time.
And I think that's a very important point. And it's worthy of their time so that they can take it and learn from it and apply it, bastardize it in their own way, run with it, come back with something different and better than you even thought of. Because it's absolutely about being up there, but it's also about that sharing and teaching, right? That the audience, it's worth their time. And it's awesome to see what can happen with it from their perspective, be it that they learn something that they, you know, they take it and apply it, or it doesn't apply to their situation and it makes you think differently. There's all of that sort of feedback and continuation that can happen from it.
It's an incredibly satisfying moment where someone takes an idea, uses it, comes back and says, so I did this and then this happened. You should really think about this. And the part about speaking that I enjoy the most is chatting with people after a talk where people have that feedback loop. And you can talk about, oh, I've done this and I've never experienced this. And it's funny that you thought this because I've never experienced that. And you start trading stories and finding middle ground. And that sense of opening up your aperture, you know, that sense of I'm here to teach something and I'm going to close the aperture a little bit because I want to make sure I tell you the best story I can in the time we have. And when it's done, you can open that aperture back up and suddenly all this other information comes flooding in.
Gosh, yes. Every time I've got a talk that I do about Jim Henson, and it's evolved into Jim Henson, the prototyper. But every time I give that presentation, there are at least half a dozen people in the audience who know more than I do about Henson. And I feel like I know a lot. And I love that people have picked up these tidbits along their lives and they share them with me, because I can learn and share with somebody. Yeah, Gates McFadden from Star Trek, she used to be a choreographer and worked with Henson movies, like in Labyrinth and stuff. And things like that blew my mind, but it's so cool because I latch on to them and I can share those further. Anyway, I digress, because we can keep going on that one forever. Not Gates McFadden and Muppets, but the other one. Finally, why do you hope others will start doing more of this presenting stuff too?
Again, selfishly, so that I can learn more. When I go to conferences, there are lots of topics that I would never grab a book on, that I would never take a class on. But when someone gets on stage or stands up in front of people, I shouldn't always say stage because it's not always a stage. When someone shares those stories, I learn something, and I learn it in a way that sometimes is far more effective than consuming information directly from a book or a website or static. Personally, I fidget and I tweet like crazy during talks and I bounce around in my head, but there's a part of my brain listening, absorbing, and taking notes. So the idea of I want more people to present because I can learn a lot more. I also feel like there are benefits to speaking that other people deserve to be aware of, and they deserve to get the benefit from it.
Yeah, I wholly agree. And the other thing is, there's an awful lot of room on the lawn. We don't need to be acting like this is some hallowed ground to be a presenter. If anything, we've got so much room on this lawn and so much more opportunity to learn. So I'm agreeing with you wholly, and I think that there are folks who sense that from time to time it's a clique or an elitist club, and I don't think it's that at all. I think that once you get there, what's the Kevin Spacey quote? When you reach the top, you're obligated to send the elevator back down. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'm at the top by any stretch. I've got a long ways to go, and I think we'd all kind of cop to that. But I think that getting people to the lawn, getting them to get up there and present their ideas, is one of the only ways that we're going to be able to take our existing ideas and evolve past them. What I mean is, if somebody's thinking about the next way to wireframe, I don't feel like I need to sit and continue to do that. Not that I have an obligation to own wireframes, but I just mean that I can kind of evolve as my career evolves. Now it's more about leadership things. How can I start to present about those and not worry about... See, now I feel like I sound like a selfish jerk. Like Russ was teaching you all about wireframes for 3 years, but now he can graduate because 37 new presenters have shown up. That's not what I mean at all, damn it.
It's a head count. All right, I see the equation here.
But it's a stack rating system, too.
It's this idea. Oh,
you all get 3% days. Raises.
Dark days. Dark reference, Russ. I think that the key for me is I want to keep going to other conferences, and I'm trying to leave design conferences behind and go to other conferences that talk about different approaches to art and science and technology. And those are always so much fun. And I have walked away from conferences and I've approached one or two speakers saying, I love the ideas coming out of your head. I think they didn't absolutely show up in your talk. Can I buy you a drink and can we talk about some of those things? Because there is nothing worse than walking away from a talk and going, there's something missing and it's a shame that it didn't show up. And you think at some point in time, if that person had a little more coaching or had a little help, that might've been there. So again, I'm a true selfish organism. I would like to see people become better speakers because it just everyone benefits. There's no downside.
I couldn't agree more. And, you know, look, the elephant in the room is that the technology industry is off balance from diversity, from a diversity perspective. And we can help that by making it easier to become a presenter, a speaker. It doesn't matter who you are, as long as you've got some ideas and you want to get out there and share them, you should be out there doing that. And we, I think, as a community, need to do that better job. So I think that's why we enlist the support of folks like you and so many of the other speaker mentors that we have to come on board and make it, you know, really easy to see that there is room on the lawn and that there is benefit to this for you to share your knowledge with others so people can continue to learn. And hopefully this is kind of a snowball effect, right?
Absolutely. And I think what's interesting is we've talked a lot about transferring knowledge, and we might have given short shrift to the simple storytelling and experience sharing, which is just as important in some situations. And to the point you just made, if we are hearing the same kinds of people tell the same kinds of stories, then it's an echo chamber, and that just sucks.
We do not want to hear Russ Unger's way of doing wireframes for the rest of our lives.
Nobody needs that.
No. You barely need to hear it just once.
and so with that in mind, you know, it's great for Russ Unger to get up on stage and do another talk on wireframing because there's always new people who need it. But at some point in time, when does that baton get passed to someone who says, hey, I've been working on this other thing. I've got another approach. Why don't you hear my story? And that's why we need more people doing it. And this one of my favorite stories of the last few years involves Denise Jacobs, who is an amazing speaker and is all over the place talking about creativity and helping people push through their creative blocks and helping folks get their ideas out. She's a wonderful woman. She's an amazing speaker. And we were hanging out at a UXPA event in DC, and I had done a little bit of an exercise where I was talking to people in the hallways and during the breaks in the events and learning about what they did and asking what their story was. And people told me amazing stories about the challenges they were facing, how they made a good thing better, or how they were just dealing with this challenge. And everything was iterate, how they were getting better. And it was everyone. And when prodded with just a few simple prompts, everyone had a story to tell. And I ended with, you should be here next year. You should be submitting a talk for UXPA. Don't be in the audience next year. Be up on stage. And Denise's eyes just lit up. She's like, yes, absolutely. And so she took a little idea and turned it into something even bigger. And she has been so cool. And she added that in as part of a talk she gives and her keynote at UX Week. It was, again, UX Week was just a series of professional highlights, because being on stage with Jesse and then getting mentioned in a keynote of, hey, this is an idea that this guy told me about. Here's something even better. I'm going to challenge everyone here, not just do about a talk, think about the talk right now. What would you talk about? She gave people and gives people a framework to spark that idea and build off it. And she's spreading that message even further of, don't be in the audience next year, be on the stage. And I think that's something that at every event, I wish it was said more in the closing moments, that sense of thank you all for being here. Here's the challenge. Next year, we want to see you on stage. We want to have you wearing that badge that has the big speaker logo on it. Because again, it's not easy, but the benefits and what you learn from it are so great.
It's one of my favorite things about the IA Summit is their new speaker support, which I've been a part of for a number of years. And because of it, I think I've also had my conference proposals, which have been accepted a million other places, get rejected there. And I've had to rewrite one so I can hopefully get it in this year. and I think it's fantastic. I think that's a great lesson that this, you know, this Russ Unger fella who's done a couple of talks has a hard time getting in because it's blind and everybody gets viewed the same. And we've got this great support system. And what you just said mirrors something that I think is a great closing point here. My first IA Summit was 2008 in Miami. 5 Minute Madness, Jesse James Garrett gets up and says something to the effect of, all of you new people should be up here next year. These people are all faking it till they make it anyway, essentially. And basically saying, you know, here's the challenge. All of you new people, get your butts on stage. And I think he's absolutely right. And I think that's what we want to have happening. And so with that, I thank you so much for being one of our mentors on October 11th at Speaker Camp Boston. And I can't wait to get to hang out and spend the day watching you share all the awesome things that you know with people who are showing up.
Thanks. I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks for listening to the Chicago Camps podcast, brought to you in partnership with Simplecast. Publish your podcasts the easy way at simplecast.fm. And learn more about Speaker Camp and other Chicago Camps events on our website at chicagocamps.org.